When trauma happens, whether it's someone dying or your family falling apart or any other type, it causes you to ask big questions. And that's where my guest found himself after being brutally attacked, almost to the point of death, by people that he was trying to help. In this episode, you'll hear him share that story of the attack. Plus, he answers questions like, how has the attack affected you over the years? Has forgiveness been difficult for you? Why forgive? What are the benefits? What happens if we don't forgive? And how do you forgive someone who has hurt you? Intense story, but good content. Keep listening. Welcome to the Restored Podcast, helping you heal and grow from the trauma of your parents' divorce, separation, or broken marriage so you can feel whole again and break the cycle. I'm your host, Joey Panarelli. This is episode 107. We're thrilled that so many of you have found the podcast so helpful and even healing. We've heard lots of feedback. One listener said, amazing, 5 stars, been looking for a podcast like this, finally found one that has helped me more than you'll ever know. Thank you. Another said, surprisingly helpful, not what I expected, 5 stars. They went on to say, I've always said that I'm okay, that what happened couldn't have changed who I was. Of course it changed me. I still run away from many topics related to divorce, but listening to this podcast isn't like hearing from a bunch of psychologists tell me all the ways I'm really okay. It's much more helpful to hear that this is not okay and it will never be okay, but I can be. Lots more reviews like that that we don't have time to share right now, but we will in the future. Again, we're so happy to hear that it's been so helpful. We do it for you. If you've ever had an idea, guest, topic, or any other advice to make this podcast better, we'd love to hear from you. To offer your advice, you can just take our podcast survey on it. We ask questions like, how would you rate the podcast? Of the options listed, why do you listen? Is the podcast length too long, too short, or just right? Should we add video? Should we change the format of the show? And other questions that'll guide you in giving your advice, which we really value. It does take 5 to 10 minutes to complete it. But if you've benefited from this podcast, think of it as a way to help us in return. It'll also come back to benefit you in 2 ways. One, it'll make the show even better for you. And 2, if you fill it out by November 15th, you'll be entered to win a $100 Amazon gift card. And so to offer your advice, it's really easy. Just go to restoredministry.com. Again, restoredministry.com/survey. Just answer the questions there, submit the form. Again, go to restoredministry.com/survey, or just click on the link in the show notes. My guest today is John O'Brien. John is the founder and executive director of the Aquinas Forum, a nonprofit organization based in Denver, Colorado, for faith formation and Catholic studies. He holds a bachelor's degree and master's degree in theology from Franciscan University of Steubenville and has taught faith formation to every age level. Beginning as a high school theology and humanities teacher, he later became the director of faith formation for a flourishing parish in Denver, Colorado. During his tenure as a parish director of formation, part of his role included directing over 240 young adults in 25 small groups. He also started a monthly candlelight mass that continues 9 years later and was the starting point for over 50 marriages, if you can believe that, to help people grow in faith and develop a Catholic vision of life is a hallmark of all of his work. So obviously in this episode, we talk about God, we talk about faith. If you don't believe in God, you're totally welcome here. Anyone listening for a while knows that this podcast is not a strictly religious show. And so wherever you're at, I'm glad you're here. If you don't believe in God, my challenge for you is this, just listen with an open mind. Even if you skip or take out the God parts, you're still going to benefit from this episode. With that, here's my conversation with John. John, welcome to the show. So good to have you, man.
Great to be here, Joey.
I've been looking forward to this, and let's dive right in. So years ago, you went through a very traumatic event.
Yep.
And I don't want to tell the story. I want you to tell the story. What happened there?
Well, there's a lot to be said, but I just completed graduate school and got the master's in theology and wanted to begin a career in teaching at some point. But for the present time, I wanted to experience this opportunity that was presented to me. A few of my college friends were going out to a ranch in Northwest Wyoming. It sounded really cool. I'd been, you know, just in the classroom forever. I was age 24, lots of paper, lots of pens, computers. Like, oh man, you spent some time in the West. That sounds good. Mm-hmm. The thing is, it was a delinquent youth ranch. And so that was a bit of a twist, but that sounded cool too, because I just wanted to go and help, be a counselor, you know, just be with the kids, take care of them.
Yeah, that's heroic. That's
You know, it felt right. Felt right for the time.
Yeah.
And kind of grow up, experience some maturity. And when I got out there, though, I'm going to have to kind of keep this simple, I think, for the sake of our timing for the podcast. But you'll get the important elements. I'd only been there for 2 weeks. Again, it was a delinquent youth ranch. So the kids that were there were used to kind of relatively small crime. Mm-hmm. But some bigger. Some violence, some just kind of over-drinking, problematic child, terrible relationships with the parents. So the parents at some point, because the children are out of control, they'd have to force them to pack up and go to the ranch.
Wow, okay.
So the kids didn't want to be there. And one night, just 2 weeks into my time at the ranch, they caught wind I was going to be the only counselor there that night. There were nine boys, middle teens.
Wow.
And the manager approved it. I didn't know what was going on because I'd only been there for 2 weeks. But the manager approved it. I was the only guy there. Treat everything as a normal day. Say a rosary before the campfire about 10 p.m. Put them down to sleep in their tent all under the Wyoming high desert.
Wow.
Beautiful area. So I put them in the tent. I get in my sleeping bag, bedroll. Not in the tent, just like under the stars. Still see the Milky Way. It was gorgeous. I was in a great mood. Like, I was looking forward to being out there for a year. 1 week later, I wake up in the hospital. The intensive care unit, Billings, Montana. And what happened was they waited until I fell asleep about 10 p.m. And then about 11:30, they said, we're going to go through with what we had planned. So they had three options. The first one was to tie me up with a rope. And their object was very simple. I had a duffel bag next to me. The truck keys were in the bag. But I was in the way. So they're like, well, let's think of a way to take care of Mr. Obi, is what they called me, Bro Brian. And they said, well, let's think of a way we can take care of Mr. Obi and then take the keys of the truck and go.
Wow.
First option was tie me up with a rope. But they said, well, he's bigger than us, and so if we get into trouble, that's not going to be good.
Yeah, you know? You're for everyone who doesn't know what John looks like, he's a tall, strong dude, so yeah.
Can't think of a joke, so I have to help that out. Just kind of a lame guy. And so that was the first option, just tie me up. They said that there could be problems. The second option was they could stab me, but they said, well, that's too violent. And then the third option, they said, and I would argue this is just as violent, but take garden shovels, try to knock me out.
Wow.
So that's what they did. They snuck out of the truck, or excuse me, they snuck out of the tent. About 11:30, they picked up garden shovels that were nearby. We were doing some work earlier in the afternoon. We used the shovels for it. They pick up the shovels. They count to three. They've surrounded me. I'm asleep. And they pound my head in for 8 to 10 hits. Because there were five other boys, right there during this whole scene, we have witness testimony, like minute to minute, you know. So one of the boys said, I think I heard 8 to 10 hits. He told the detective, and it sounded like an aluminum bat hitting rocks. That was me.
Did you wake up through that?
I did wake up, but I don't have any memory of it. I didn't lose any consciousness during this experience, but I was knocked into shock, so I don't remember it.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Yeah, seriously. Wow.
So anyways, I'm on the sleeping bag, kind of left for dead. One of the boys goes back to the other boys that were in the tent and said, you know, get out of here. Let's go hop in the truck. And they're all scared for the life, of course, so they do it. One boy not involved in the assault puts on his cowboy boots and runs like hell to the staff house. He saved my life.
Wow.
If it wasn't for him, if he would have thought more about his own safety than me, I would be in the great beyond. As wow. You call it, Joey, the great beyond.
My goodness.
So he runs and gets help, but before they take off, this episode really haunted me in the first few years. I was struggling with things. He comes back from the truck just to kind of make sure, I don't know, I'm not dangerous for their plot. And I'm kind of sitting up in my sleeping bag, just bloodied and just a wreck, because the assault immediately caused a skull fracture, hand fracture, a subdural hematoma, a blood clot started forming on the brain. And so I was out of it. Well, he kneels down because I'm sitting on my bedroll, just kind of dazed, the other boy said. And he bends down, kind of looks at my face, looks at my eyes. and then takes a step back and just kicks me. And bad scene. It's interesting. I've never gotten emotional about that scene. I have a little bit of a PhD, Joey, in disassociation.
Hmm. Fair enough.
So that happens. Of course, I'm out. They hop in the truck. They take off. They're caught later that night, right, by the Wyoming Highway Patrol. I'll talk very soon here about kind of their what happened to them. But so I'm in the sleeping bag. About a half an hour later, staff comes and gets help. A half an hour later, staff comes, loads me up in a truck because they said the ambulance was not going to know where it is. Probably true. They take me by ambulance to a huge road in front of the ranch. An ambulance comes. Then I'm airlifted to Billings, Montana. They call my mom. I'm airlifted to Billings, Montana, where there was a neurosurgeon in charge and just trying to gauge how I'm going to do. He calls my mom and dad. And, you know, they say, of course, doctor, whatever you need to do. Well, he operates. He takes a 3x3-inch piece of skull out. He puts it in the freezer to where it was going to be left for 5 months just to keep it safe is my brain, right?
Wow.
As my brain swells down and as my brain tries to heal. And so they put me under a medical coma. I wake up 5 days later. Mm. Definitely brain injury. If for anyone who's experienced brain injury, they know, well, there's all sorts of stuff that can happen. But one of the things is you really kind of start over at a young age. So just, I don't know if you're going to want to call it lack of focus, just you're super, super young.
Yeah.
And on medicine. And so it was a time, it was a ramp up. I recovered for 1 year. I went home. After 2 weeks in the hospital,
wow!
I go home, started speech therapy, started physical therapy, had to walk on, you know, the treadmills and take care of everything. And I was brain injured, so it was a little bit like you're drunk. And so I'd say all sorts of inappropriate things, acute nurses and such. Hopefully, made them at least laugh. And so recovered for a year. And that was the physical part, and then the psychological part was much longer. But that's the basics. The boys were. They went to jail for a couple of years and, you know, got out. And I know some of them have had trouble who, you know, participated in the assault, those four boys. Some of them continue to have trouble with the law. I'm hoping a couple others are doing better.
Wow, that's so good of you to say that. I know that must have taken a while for you to just want the best for them, or maybe not. Maybe you're more heroic and virtuous than I am.
Oh,
but my goodness,
I wish,
man,
I was.
That is intense. Yeah, so many questions. I guess kind of fast forwarding mm-hmm. a little bit more too, what were the effects that followed you through that? You said there were a lot of psychological, I know the physical and I'm sure mental and all that good stuff. So just if you would outline it for us, how that affected you in the years that followed.
Yeah, well, you could think of it just as this is the way I used to talk about it, just as a tornado of problems because you had two things going on. You had the trauma, yes, right? How crazy that story was and how difficult and kind of the mystery of good and evil, which is very often accompanies trauma. And that was a difficult thing. But then on the other hand, I had the neuropsychological effects, or perhaps for the podcast, I should say, I had the physiological effects of the brain injury, which were very difficult. Concretely, irritability, sleep conditions, depression.
Yeah.
Kind of a OCD, kind of an obsessive mind about all sorts of things. It felt like kind of my poor brain, if you will, is just like on fire. Whereas before, it just kind of felt more healthy, functioning and active, mm-hmm. right? But now it's on fire. So any little thing. And for people who have experienced this, they know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yep.
So I had that. And then let's just throw in some disassociation, depersonalization, where you literally feel, it's kind of like you feel dizzy, but you're living in your daily life, but you feel like you're not real, or you feel like life's not real, mm-hmm. or you feel like every day is episodic. So I experienced about 10 years, my friend, just to mention this in particular.
Wow.
I experienced 10 years at least of, because it's been 18 years now, experienced 18 years of deep, strong depersonalization, of the, gosh, I know I'm real, but it kind of doesn't even feel like that, or the outside world. And it kind of feels like you're like about 10,000 miles above your head.
Yeah.
It's very odd.
Like an out-of-body experience.
That's
almost.
Right. That's
okay.
Right.
Wow. Like disconnect from reality in a way.
Very much.
Yeah.
And so there were lots.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
And that's just to mention the physiological. That's not the psychological. Well, specifically, that's not a whole lot of the psychological of trauma, forgiveness, hope, meaning, all those things.
100%. And I know we're going to hone in on that because there's so many ways we could take this conversation. But on the OCD bit, yeah, that is such a understated problem that a lot of people deal with. I know I've went through my bouts of dealing with it and know people who deal with it. It's so debilitating. So that alone is enough. But one of the things that strikes me is from your story is that there's just so much, like you said, a tornado or an avalanche is another way to say it. It's just like just overwhelming. So it's just amazing that you're standing here today. Like there's so many people I think would be tempted to just give up.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's beautiful that you're here and you've pushed through all that. And yeah, you've become like an inspiration for so many people too. So I want to shift to forgiveness.
Yes.
Everyone listening here, you know, has been hurt in some way and they might see some value in forgiveness. They might want to forgive, but they struggle. They struggle to forgive for any number of reasons. Has forgiveness been difficult for you?
Yes and no. I think yes in the sense that, you know, I knew Joey when I went out there to be a counselor at the ranch. I knew they were delinquent youth. They were in a bad place in life. And likely they were in a bad place of life because of decisions that, at least to some degree, were based on unjust things that happened to them. To both and, right? All of this is contextualized by both and. If you're looking for an extreme or just a simple answer in any of this, perhaps, you know, well, I don't want to talk to you because reality, one famous Jesuit said, reality is like a strong red wine. It's not for children.
Mm.
There's a lot to it. So
it's nuanced.
That's right. It's nuanced.
It's not the black and white that is so often made out to be, especially in like our media. Or anywhere in the world, really. It's like, it's not, it's colorful. It's like detailed. It's nuanced. So yeah, I appreciate you saying that.
Absolutely. And so the forgiveness of the boys, believe it or not, was much easier than other aspects of forgiveness because I knew, you know, I knew they're in a bad place. I didn't know they were going to do that, of course, but they simply wanted to be free. They were used to a drug problem. I think two of them, it came out, were pining for drugs at the time. And in the mystery of what can only be called evil, this is what happens, that when, you know, there's something in between me and my addictive object or whatever that might be, it's like, it's not personal, bro. I have to take you out because I need this.
Mm.
The object of my addiction, the object of my vice, whatever that might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just taken out. And so I did pray, but, and I think there's perhaps a grace in this, but I did forgive them, completely forgive them, and I do still. The issue of forgiveness that I had, actually, I had more of an issue when it comes to forgiveness with people who were deeply faith-based, like I was, going out there Catholic, and yet after this assault, especially people associated with the ranch, who knew this could mean bad stuff legally, it's like they kind of took off their faith hat and put on their I want to protect my money hat.
Wow.
And you talk about getting fired up.
That would get
for
me fired up.
And anger and resentment, forgiveness, really struggled with big time. And that took years. That took years because I didn't know what to do with that. Here I was suffering so much, honestly, because of the brain injury and then the trauma. And, you know, I was a mess. And yet I did start full-time work less than a year after.
Wow.
Full-time campus minister, full-time teacher, prep school out in Southern California. And for a brain injury victim like that to start full-time work less than a year after is tall order. And it was difficult when I thought about how the people at the ranch associated with the ranch responded to my situation, protecting their money more than being there for me, supporting me, even kind of as a person. That was difficult. I understand, again, both and. I understand you're going to have to protect your place or your job legally, but but also to support a person who's gone through something very difficult, I think 100%. Is important. They didn't. So that took a while. I'm glad to say that has been reconciled too, beautiful. But that took a while.
Yeah, I bet. And it makes sense that it sounds like the kids would be even easier to forgive.
Yeah.
Because you kind of had that expectation of them being rough around the edges and struggling in a lot of ways, coming from really rough backgrounds, having that dependence on substances and stuff like that. Whereas with the, you know, people who are leading you or in management, whatever, you had somewhat of an expectation of like safety and,
that's
and
right.
caring for you. So it makes sense why that would be the case.
I had expectations of perhaps appropriate response from that situation. And in my opinion, the way I received it, I was like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
Interestingly, the person I struggled with most after that assault, and I have no problem sharing this, is God himself. You know, when you almost die, it was an 80% mortality rate. In today's day and age, people don't often in the United States of America in these days, they don't often experience physical pain as a result of being on mission. I did. And so I couldn't relate to Jesuits or missionaries to the New World with the Native Americans who did not understand why they were there. And they experienced martyrdom, some of them, as well as the old Jesuits in different countries in Europe and in Asia. I couldn't relate to those guys. I know they died because of their faith, but I was in a different situation. I was helping out on a ranch, yes, because of my faith. I wanted to help the boys, but also because I was in the U.S. and that doesn't happen. So I had a little conversation with God one time. I said, I'm going to have to know all of these things are real, what I believe in, beyond a shadow of a doubt. Right now, I'm struggling so bad that I'm wondering, how can you let this happen? Mm-hmm. How can you let this happen? I had a master's in theology, so I kind of knew the theological answers, at least to a degree. But it was kind of the personal existential things of this is just not making sense. And also the witness of some of these people, the Catholics, because of my understanding of how they had responded to the situation, I was pissed. And I was thinking, well, this doesn't feel real. If they believe in what they believe, how are they responding this way? And it was more than just a couple people. And so I said to God very directly, what's going on? I'm going to have to search. I was reading in a journal just the other day, written that same year of recovery. I said to God, and this is dangerous because you're putting him in the dock this time. I said, I will not believe if there is a very reasonable doubt.
Yeah.
That started a long journey of how to deal with this. And God, I remember showing my high schoolers in class for theology that scene out of Forrest Gump where Lieutenant Dan is up on high in the ship, and Forrest Gump is worried about him because there's a huge storm. But Lieutenant Dan had some things to say to God. He said, you can't hurt me. Something to the effect of, you can't hurt me. What I do remember is, you son of a bitch. And I think that prayer, looking back, was just fine. I think that's a good prayer, in fact. And I shared with my high school students, sometimes in life, that's the prayer you should pray. If you really want to know God and his will, at certain times, that's a prayer.
Yeah, because it's so real. It's so, like, this is what I'm going through, and not meant to be like, you know, if you're a person of faith, like, disrespectful to God. It's more like, hey, I'm struggling here.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is what I'm actually going through. I could put on a mask and pretend I'm not.
That's right.
That's what a lot of people do. I can be, like, super pious and everything on the exterior looks good, but interiorly I'm just, like, so broken and struggling.
That's exactly right. And I had to hold two principles. I had to hold the principle of fake it until you make it. To a degree, that's like the most practical advice we can hear in life.
Yeah.
And that is not being fake. That is putting one foot in front of the other to live a relatively productive life in the midst of going through difficulty. And then the other thing is holding this tension of God and daily life. By no means a simple thing, especially with the psychological struggles I was having, because it took about 5 years after that assault just to simmer down that brain to I would call still a high octane level, but it didn't feel as much like it was on fire. And everyone who has had a brain injury can relate to this, or if you've been the family member of a brain injured person.
Yeah, no, that makes so much sense. Yeah, I think of like Navy SEALs who have TBI or like go through the traumatic brain injury, like that stuff. It's like, it's real. It's, man, it's a whole world that I don't understand fully, but through your experience, it's super instructive. And wow, that's a heavy cross to bear.
And one thought on that is, please, there were many years, right? Because this is a many year journey recovery. It will be just a journey of a difficult thing I experienced in my life for the rest of my life. But there were many years of acute years of difficulty. And many times I kind of wish that I could have at least been part of a kind of band of brothers. SEALs certainly couldn't have made it as a SEAL.
Me neither.
But Air Force, I could have done Air Force or a different branch, because at least then I would have had some kind of fellowship with people who had gone through it, or professionals who were there for like this huge group. I just felt very alone because, you know, I did solicit help for the brain in psychology, and they were helpful, but I was still walking that path alone.
Wow.
That was hard.
Yeah, that's so isolating and so hopeless at times, honestly.
Yes.
Like, so tempted to despair, I'm sure. I've been there.
Oh, yeah. About 5 p.m. every day after my first year teaching, I'd think, okay, this is a suboptimal situation, recovering from this injury, still experiencing effects, and this job is sought to deal with. So, brother-in-law, where's the scotch?
Yeah, I hear you.
When I was living with them.
Yeah, yeah. It makes sense that we cope with pain in the ways that we do, even if they're not healthy. Like, it's not something we want to continue doing, but I get why people do that. I get why I've done that, struggle with vices in the past, where it's like, they serve a purpose. They're not good for us, but they serve a purpose, and hopefully we can break free and find a healthier alternative. But yeah, I totally get why we go down that path.
That's right. And I like how you said that it makes sense. And I would say, actually, it's natural. As a Thomas Aquinas man, started a nonprofit called the Aquinas Forum. I'm obsessed with Thomas Aquinas because, more than anyone, a Dominican friar from the 1200s helped my life. Get into that later if you want. But he's all about faith and reason. And he's going to say that if someone is deeply struggling, they are consciously aware that they want to feel healthier, right? But then the question becomes, what good am I seeking for that health? And he makes a distinction between real and apparent goods. Hmm. So in that situation, a scotch, hanging out with my brother-in-law, a scotch, its effects on the brain, it tastes good, it calms you down, good times with the brother-in-law, that seems like a great good. And perhaps one day it is. That's awesome. The meaning of alcohol, Aquinas says, is festivity. So that's good. That's a purpose. That's good. Fine. But as it relates to a brain injury, it's not a true good. It's not a real good at all. It's going to be an apparent good.
Wow.
And that's kind of the drama of the moral life is, am I choosing real goods or apparent goods? And it took me a while to get back on the train of real goods rather than just kind of quick fixes that were going to make me feel better. But for people who are going through addiction or battling vices, it's a healthy psychological principle, I believe, to realize there's a reason you're doing this. Loneliness, brain injury, hurt, depression, stress from job, whatever the vice is, it's almost always going to be an apparent good to help you. And so the realization is you're not weird for wanting health and trying to find something or experiencing something that does help you, makes you think it's helping. But the reality of it is we want to be moving more towards those real goods.
Yeah, and things that are going to help in the long run, not just in the short term, not be like a quick fix. And yeah, I know for me as a teenager, it was pornography. That was my drug of choice. And it helped me in the moment. It almost sounds scandalous to say that, but it's true. It served a purpose, but it was making me miserable. And so I knew I needed to get that out of my life. And I did, thankfully. But yeah, I recognize now looking back, it's like, yeah, it did. It served a purpose. And I wish I didn't fall into that. But yeah, I was in a very rough spot.
There's a reason why you did it. Yeah. Loneliness, what have you. And then you experience this and it draws you in to another world. It would be actually a false ecstasy. And then when this takes over you, there's a, like, this is what I experience. You think, what kind of a person am I with all these vices? It must be some kind of a monster.
Yeah.
Because, so to speak, a vice takes over you. It literally does, but it feels like almost like another power. And like you said, say, well, this was just the wrong decision. An Irish priest once defined sin to me as, it seemed like a good idea at the time. You know, everyone can relate to that.
Yeah, no, 100%. And I love where you're pointing people. It's like, there's a, maybe one way to say it is like, there's a little bit of a monster inside of us that like acts out at times, but we're both the good and the bad in the sense that, you know, if we choose to do bad, like that doesn't fully define us. Like there's a reason that we're doing that. We should stop doing that and do the good. But there's a reason we go in that direction. And if you shame yourself thinking like, no, I just not, don't just do bad, I am bad, then the chance of you like coming back from that is like greatly diminished.
It is.
But if you can see yourself as like, I'm both the vices and the virtues that I hold. I'm both. And I want to reduce the vices and increase the virtues. But if I want to pretend I'm just the virtues or say like I'm limited to just these vices, then I'm going to be debilitated and probably give up and just live a horrible life.
Yep. That's right.
Let's go back to forgiveness.
Let's do it.
Someone say it's easier not to forgive.
Okay.
It's too much hard work. It's too difficult. So the question really is, to someone, especially in this position right now, like they've been hurt. They kind of feel like they should forgive or they've heard they should forgive, but they're not really compelled to do that because it's so painful. Why forgive? What are some of the benefits that you've experienced or you've thought of or you've learned from Aquinas about forgiveness?
Well, first of all, you know, there's a sense in which there's a great dignity that should be given to someone who's gone through something very, very difficult. You know, Pope John Paul II, one of my heroes, he writes this about suffering, that suffering is uniquely your own, right? Hopefully that does not turn us into narcissists who kind of use that as like a victim mentality and have a like a flag over your head. Of look at me, no one understands me, although that is a feeling.
Yeah.
But I would say to that person, okay, fair enough. That's what you feel like. It's going to be a lot of work and it sounds like you're an intense chapter in your journey. But let me ask you this question. Is it worth it? Is it worth the work? Mm. If you have a 1,000-pound stone on your back that we call resentment and hurt, and you have a bridge that you can walk over that is a bridge such that that 1,000-pound rock will take off you. Does that sound appealing to you?
Yeah.
Compared to just walking around in this valley with a 1,000-pound brick? Because I think the effect of unforgiveness and hurt and resentment, bitterness, makes it worth it to pursue a kind of alleviation of that rock. So it's very practical. You know, I like to be a reality guy more than anything in the world. Please, God. Very practically speaking, if you're struggling with unforgiveness about something big, you have a huge rock on your shoulder. Mm. And it helps when someone comes up to you who has a 500-pound rock or a 1,000, perhaps a 10,000-pound rock. And I've met a couple of those people. And at one point, they had that rock on their shoulders, but they don't anymore. And here I was at the 1,000-pound rock. I said, can we have a chat?
Wow.
So very practically, I would say.
I love that. And I want to continue on that road for a second.
Yep.
Yeah, just playing out like that resentment. Like we don't really often think about like, what happens if you don't forgive? How is that holding you back in life? Because that might feel like the default position. And so aside from resentment, and feel free to go deeper into that, what else do you think happens if we don't forgive? How does that damage us? Because we kind of think of it as not forgiving damages the person who hurt me. Mm-hmm. But I've heard it said that not forgiving someone is like drinking poison and expecting the other person to die.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, the person I needed to forgive was God. That sounds so presumptuous, it's crazy. But you know what? That was real for me.
Yeah.
I'm a bit of a black and white guy at times of, okay, either this faith or my faith is true, all of it, or perhaps none of it. Either God is in control of everything because he's God, so presumably he would be, or it's not. It's the opposite. So, you know, if he isn't there, if he is not there, he is not in control of everything. And so it's a total shit show. It's total chaos. Mm-hmm. And that's what trauma feels like. That's what unforgiveness can feel like because of the hurt that your experience has caused. And so with forgiveness and unforgiveness, again, that's a question that follows a terrible experience, a bad experience. Mm-hmm. What I want to focus on in my life and back then is the experience itself. It's kind of like, how do I process this experience? And then that dictates, is forgiveness reasonable? Is it not? If I would propose, if God is not real, if he's not in control of all of this, including moral laws, a bad experience may be unfortunate for you. You feel pain, but it's not violating some ultimate moral law and everything is absolute chaos and contradiction.
Yeah,
that's a suboptimal place to be in life, feeling that.
It's a heavy place to be.
But if on the other hand that there's been an experience of reality in your life that is causing such a pain, and this gets to your question now, it's a 1,000-pound rock you're carrying. It's a disease. It feels like another person. You're another person right now. And so who the hell cares about forgiveness right now? You're conscientious, and I was conscientious of, this is not good. This is not a good feeling to have. This is not a good place to be. It feels like life itself is a prison. And so forgiveness is a possibility to help out with that situation, and it did me. It did me. I'll tell you why, because forgiveness is a way out of that to some degree. But I want to stop there because that answers your question.
Yeah.
I would not say it's unforgiveness that is the main issue. The main issue is going to be the experience you had.
100%.
And the pain that led to. And forgiveness is a healthy way out.
I hear you.
Not the only, but a healthy way out.
Yeah. No, I hear you. And I think some people hear about forgiveness and they actually think that they need to jump to that prematurely.
Yep.
It's actually something that happens like later in the healing process, if we want to call it that. It's not something that happens right away. And I want to get into like the steps of healing, which I know they're not totally linear, but I think there are some good principles there that we crack into. But
it's like the word you just said a few minutes ago. It's nuanced.
It's nuanced.
Other levels.
Yeah, totally. But I think it's actually harmful to try to forgive too soon. And, yeah, and one of the steps that are the principles that I've heard about forgiveness is truly understanding like the cost. Like what it's the ways in which you were damaged, not to remain a victim forever. I love that you brought up the victim mentality thing because I think we all could be tempted to that. But to truly move beyond it, to close that chapter in your life, and to move on. Not that it will never come up again, but that you're in a better, stronger spot. You're able to move forward. So if someone came up to you now and said, "John, there's someone who really harmed me. I want to forgive them. I just have no clue how to go about that." What would you say? What advice would you give them?
It's interesting. You know, it's been 18 years. I get a little emotional about that question because it's a powerful one. The first thing I'd say to that one is, if a person came up to me and asked me that, first step is, let's grab a cup of coffee. I want to hear about your story. I call it swapping stories because it's a light way in. If someone's gone through something very difficult, I don't like to get into solution mode, solutionize them. I like to say, dude, let's get together. Let's swap some stories. And within the context of that story, I think it would unfold itself, the pain, the difficulty, the hurt, and then that how forgiveness might be one of their main hangups to prevent freedom. Because unforgiveness, it's a grasping. It's kind of a false grasping in my experience, kind of a false control. You think, well, I've been hurt and I'm not going to be hurt again by whatever the other person thinks and intends or what have you.
Yeah.
It can be even a kind of paranoia. So within that context, I try to find out where they're at, and then perhaps skipping ahead, perhaps not, but I would try to share from my own experience and then ultimately pointing to reality that as difficult as the things are that we can experience, life is greater than that. Life is much greater than that. And I think forgiveness typically associated with zooming in on something that seems to be all-encompassing. And yet, if we can take a step back, and this is the importance of story and sharing your story, feeling like someone else freaking cares, you can see kind of a bigger vista, if you will, a bigger landscape. And that's hope. So unforgiveness, I think, is very much tied to hope. Like, screw this, screw that. It's resentment mode. It's bitterness mode. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you see a greater landscape of, okay, this is a difficult thing I have to deal with, and the resentment, unforgiveness I have, but now at least I can see a greater reality that life may offer me an experience of joy and happiness that I could not experience if I keep zoned in on this terrible thing.
Okay. That makes so much sense. And I love that idea too, that you allude to of when people hurt you, you rightly feel that they owe you some sort of a debt.
I think that's right.
Yeah. And so unforgiveness, I guess, would look like demanding that debt in some way. And I want to be careful here. In some situations, it's very important that person does pay the debt. Mm-hmm. It's important that those, in my opinion, that those kids went to prison.
Yes.
Like they needed to. But that's not up to you to impose that punishment. It's up to a third party, law enforcement, mm-hmm. to impose that so that you're free then to release them of any further debt that they might owe you.
Yeah.
And so that's the act of forgiveness, but it's not easy and it's not linear and it's messy. And I've been there. There can be things that you really hold on tightly. You want to forgive, but it's like, I just can't let this go at this point in my life. And if you're there listening right now, I would say that's okay.
Yep.
Like don't force it. Like you can keep working towards that, but it's not something that maybe you're ready to do right now. Maybe there's some initial, like John's advising you on, like maybe there's some initial steps that you need to be taking, like going deeper into your story, having someone who's there just listening to you, walking with you, which will then free you to get rid of that resentment, to forgive and free that person of that debt that they owe you. Anything, Dan?
I think that's right. I think there's a lot there. I think everything you said is true. I also think that the biggest kind of principle for me going through all this was one thing. What is really real? What the F is real here? Because if I know it's real, then I can understand my terrible experience. I can understand people's responses. I can understand even my own interior world, kind of according to that. If things are real, if you will, if things are stable, and then if I can kind of seek to live a life in communion with ultimately what's real, rather than get caught up in what I call kind of the spider web above my brain of trying to connect all the pieces. And I did that for 5 years. If you will, I got a master's degree in that. And I said, that master's degree sucks because it does not work. You're just chasing everything up in this spider web compared to asking that more fundamental, admittedly abstract question, what is really real? Because I think there's an answer. And when someone knows what's really real and they live according to that, they know or they think that there is a pattern of reality. There are signposts within which we can contextualize our lives and everything we do. And there's at least a sense of, okay, things are okay at root. One of the worst things about trauma, I think the worst, is that it changes your understanding of everything. Whereas you feel like the cosmos itself, it's spinning. Whereas if you ask that question, what is really real? You take a slow journey to your point of understanding that, then everything becomes contextualized. Unforgiveness, resentment, spite, bitterness, even depression.
Wow.
You can say, okay, this is an issue. This is very difficult in my life, but it's not what is most really real. And so I at least have a little bit of time and there's a sense of like, okay, I'm okay for now. I have a journey. There's lots ahead, but I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm at least to a degree safe because I know that reality is safe. Wow. Boy, that was the worst for me. It felt like reality itself wasn't safe.
Yeah. Can imagine like watching your back constantly.
That's right. Even to this day, every week, once or twice a week, I will, for some reason, it's at gas stations when I'm filling up my car or at the counter buying a soda, I will feel like if someone's behind me, just automatically, not conscientiously, or it's unconscious, but I will feel like someone's going to come over me and hit me on the head, and kind of the feeling of shudders, you know, in the body. And that, I mean, that's been going on, Joey, for 18 years, and it's not of out of control experience. I still don't control to this point. I think, okay, well, there it is again. Just experienced like 0.5 seconds of terror.
My goodness.
But it was 0.5 seconds, you know, and it's not real.
Yeah.
Right? Not everyone at the gas station is going to assault me.
Yeah.
I think lots of people can relate to that kind of an experience.
Yeah. Man, that's intense. And thank you for sharing so vulnerably throughout this whole interview. You are very real. And what are some maybe myths or misunderstandings about forgiveness that you've observed that are like really, really unhelpful that you want to warn people against?
Yeah, I would say the first one and the most annoying is perhaps the cheesy or cliche Christian one, including all forms of Christian. I happen to be Catholic, and so, you know, I'm Christian, and so a response of like, if someone says, do you forgive them? Say, absolutely. with a certain kind of tone of voice and kind of whisper. And you say, "Really, man?" And yeah, I want to punch these people. But really, I don't, because you know what they're trying to do? They're trying to do the best they can on their own journey.
Yeah. It's more about them than about you at that point.
It is. And, you know, okay, that's how they're dealing with. But the issue is, again, you just mentioned that word real, and it's not real. You know, the act of the will of forgiving, and I like to get into that, kind of, we need to define forgiveness.
Please.
That often is not defined, and it's terrible.
Great.
Because if you're trying to do something that you don't know what the hell it is, that's not good. Because you won't do it, because you don't know what it is.
It's how,
like,
would you?
Yeah. It's like, well, I need to get healthier, but I have no idea what healthy is. And so I'm obsessing all day long about being healthy, but I don't know what it is. So I have to lean on my man, Thomas Aquinas, and I'm going to paraphrase him. If there are any expert Thomas out there, please forgive me for paraphrasing this. But I read at one point, it was a lightning bolt of clarity for me, that he said forgiveness has to do with seeing the other person as more than the harm that they've inflicted and seeking to love the wholeness of who that person truly is.
Wow.
Rather than that experience of them inflicting harm.
So good.
Right. And that comes from 800 years ago, because the real is really real. It doesn't change, folks. Wow. People in ancient Greece, now it's the same humanity. Human nature is constant, doesn't change. And so forgiveness has always been possible since the dawn of human history. And so step one is understanding, okay, this is what that is. Now, the next thing becomes, am I going to, by an act of the will alone is the important principle here, am I going to lean into that? And it indeed is a lean. I am a big fan of forgiveness as a journey. It truly is. It is not a journey of emotions. In fact, essentially, emotions has nothing to do with it.
Wow.
It's an act of the will.
A good principle in that, I was just thinking, if you're waiting for your emotions, if you're waiting to feel like you want to forgive the person, in a sense, like, you're going to be waiting forever.
That's right. Yeah. You'll be waiting forever. Yeah, that doesn't work. And we are in a hyper-emotional culture. Hyper-emotional. Now, I'm a passionate guy. I've got Irish blood. Nice. You know, John Slattery O'Brien.
Love it.
Fairly Irish name. And so, boy, I got that. That is difficult blood to have when you're going through these experiences. But
yeah.
I would say a silver lining of my entire experience has been, I have learned the relationship between emotion and will, emotion and intellect and will, or decision, right? And the relation of all that to happiness. And I've learned that you can be living an objectively happy day and kind of good day, an ordered day, and still feel like a wreck. And that, you know what? That's actually pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because that, at least there's peace.
Yeah.
Because peace, as Aquinas says, is the tranquility of order. Peace is not some emotion, essentially. It's a tranquility of order, and we feel that, right? And so, as it relates to forgiveness, if we make this decision to forgive and to grow in that forgiveness, we are choosing to see that person as more than just their harm, their evil. And because that's true, we can have the experience of a little bit more order in our souls, in our minds and wills, according to what's really real, right? Rather than, okay, I'm going to focus in on the harm they inflicted, and it's going to be the only thing I see, and it's going to make me just a bitter, unpleasant person. Mm-hmm. Well, A, that sucks. B, it's actually not in accordance with reality as much as seeing the person for who they are.
Wow.
As a whole. And so that's where it begins.
Yeah.
If people don't know the definition, like, abstractly, we still know what it is, kind of enough, but it does help to get into what it is per se. So we begin that journey with the will, and then all of a sudden, you know what we do is, I think, you know, is what I experience, we become a little bit more integrated, because we're seeing the whole. You know, think of just the most bad military person you've ever met, or firefighter, or doctor, or cop. They have seen everything. And you know what? You go up and talk to them about it. Like, man, what have experiences you've seen? And it's just been a nightmare. And they're like the chillest people on earth. 100%. They see reality more than they would if they're just zoned in on that one particular experience. I want to be very clear again. This is a both and.
Yeah.
It's not some simple answer that clears everything up. The good news is that the real is really real. And we can seek to live in accordance with that, with reality. And then we become, in time, it's a journey of integration, a better scenario, a better kind of place to be on the journey, I would say, than sitting in your home obsessing about how much you hate this person.
Yeah. There's so much freedom there and kind of leaving that behind.
It is, you know, when I share these things, because I'm a pretty philosophical guy, I am concerned that it's a little bit over the top abstract. What's your sense of that right now?
No, I think it's helpful. And I think maybe being a little bit more general is helpful because then people can fill in the blanks. You know?
I think that's right. I like general. I think that's a good word because general, again, relates to that sense of reality, like reality is bigger than we make it. And the important thing is to gather principles for this and we're not alone. And there are principles and reality is big and then there's hope.
Yeah.
So you don't need to be a philosophy just nerd like I am to want to grow on these things. I think the important thing is, in some sense, even better, is to just have a kind of on the ground understanding of these principles.
So good. Man, this has been so enlightening. I've learned a lot from you in this interview and I appreciate your time. And just if people want to go deeper and learn more about Aquinas, about what you offer, tell us about your nonprofit. What do you guys actually offer and how does it benefit people?
That's right. So I have a nonprofit called the Aquinas Forum. Started 3.5 years ago, and it's very simple. It's an independent nonprofit that helps people grow in faith and develop a Catholic worldview. It's all about faith and reason, the relationship between faith and reason, which is constitute a lot of our chat here.
Yeah.
Because it's easy to live based on only faith. We call that fideism, not paying enough attention to the here and the now, the order of nature of reality, or to live only off of reason, which is going to be rationalism. And because there's a clear limit to our reason, that is not going to give nearly as much kind of hope and a greater view of the landscape of reality or even what it could be if you don't have faith. And so both of these alone, I would say, are not ideal. Whereas if you integrate these things, that's a beautiful life. Again, my hero, Pope John Paul II said, faith and reason are like two wings upon which the human soul ascends to the mystery of God. You know, that's good.
Yeah.
Wow. And it's real.
I hear you.
And so I started this nonprofit to help people grow in that. I worked at a parish for a number of years. I felt like I learned some of the skills to do this. So to speak, I had a product to offer. Started this nonprofit. We do different things locally, conferences, book studies, classes. But then I've also opened up this wing through my website that we offer people free resources for small groups.
Nice.
The how-to guide for leaders or hosts, as well as the studies themselves written by some great authors. And it's actually helping people to grow in what's really real, scripture, a little bit of philosophy. We have Bible studies up now and it's good stuff. And the hope is hope in a sense, wherever you are on the journey, that the real is really real and that there's hope ahead. There are good things ahead and they're actually good things right now for your life.
Love it. Yeah. And so whether someone's maybe been on some sort of spiritual journey for a while, they can join, or if someone's in the beginning of it and just like questioning things, they're welcome as well. Is that right?
That's right. So locally we have things where people can come and they can come from any faith background or none because Thomas Aquinas, it's the Aquinas Forum, he was all about one question and that's this, what is God? And so through reason and faith, he explored that. And so we have lots of people that come that are just kind of seekers.
Like, yeah.
You know, what is this? Is there anything to this? And that's good. And in time, we're starting to open up other Aquinas forums throughout the country. We have two that are about to open, and that's why I named it Forum. It's a forum where people of any faith, or the Catholic faith, or no faith, can come and explore the deeper questions of life. And then also the small group initiative we have through the website that helps people do that in what I call their own corners of the world.
So you know,
a living room, a tavern, whatever.
Love it. Yeah, I love that you're facilitating that and guiding it. That sounds amazing. How can people find you online?
Aquinasforum.org. Just go and check us out. You can find the email there, the info email that will come to us, or I can give my email now, Aquinas Forum.
Yeah, are you open to people contacting you?
Absolutely. I love to chat with people on the journey because, candidly, that's what I was looking for years. Mm. Again, kind of a unique experience, faith experience I had on the ranch, trauma, but then also brain injury. That's quite the intersection of things to go together. And I just wanted someone to chat with and swap stories. Eventually found one or two is great. So I love to do that now with other people. And you know what I like to say, and I've found this is a great principle of freedom for other people as it has for me, is this. There's no red bow. If we go through something terrible in this life, there it's okay that there's not necessarily going to be a big red bow you put on top of it of like, this is why it happened and this is what it means in a holistic sense. Trauma, it's intuitively bigger than that. That's why we have to ask the question, is there an afterlife? Because as Plato said, injustice will not be corrected in this world. I mean, Hitler killed how many millions of people, right?
Yeah.
That per se cannot be corrected in this world. But in the afterlife, through justice and through how God deals with all of this, including the victims of what they've gone through, we have great hope for different reasons that this can be reconciled. And so just want to help people with that, try to offer some initiatives that can slowly, including me meeting up with people. We won't talk about a red bow, but we will talk about some principles, I think, that can lead to greater freedom.
Beautiful.
Happiness, really.
Yeah, no, that's so good. And we all want to be happy. And no, I love what you said. And I love that you're so open and so generous with your time. I appreciate you offering that.
Yeah, I'm happy too. This has been a great treat.
Yeah. And everyone listening right now, if you're just wrestling with those big questions, or maybe you've never thought about those, I would say you are worth seeking answers to those questions. Like, you deserve that. You deserve asking those big questions and finding answers. And this is one resource that you can use to do that. So how can people contact you if they...
Yeah, like? So again, it's AquinasForum.org is going to be my website. And then my personal email through the forum is John, J-O-H-N, at AquinasForum.org. A-Q-U-I-N-A-S as in Sam, forum.org. Love to hear from you.
Beautiful. And we'll throw that in the show notes so you guys can just copy and paste that as well. Want to give you the final word here. What final advice, encouragement, challenges would you offer to everyone listening, especially those listening right now who feel very stuck because of the trauma they've endured in their lives? Like, what would you leave them with?
Keep moving forward. Keep moving forward. For 10 years of my life, I felt like such a wreck. And I would consider, man, you know, in a sense, what would be the greatest encouragement I could hear right now? Because there are so many questions and thoughts and feelings floating around that, you know what I wanted? I wanted someone to say, John, the most valiant thing you can do right now is keep moving forward. Put one foot in front of the other on this road to greater health, because there are answers. And I felt like that was the greatest thing I could do. And wherever you are, whatever you're going through, if you are putting one foot in front of the other and you're moving forward, even if that's so slow, you want to take bigger steps, but you can only take a small step, that's what you have control of. And that's where you can find heroism.
If you want more content, more guidance on the topic of forgiveness, I highly recommend episode 58 of the show. I spoke with an expert who did his PhD dissertation actually on forgiveness. Lots of great advice in that episode. Again, that's episode 58, or you can just click on the link in the show notes. Quick reminder that if you'd like to offer your advice on how to make the podcast even better, just go to restoredministry.com/survey, answer the questions there, and submit the form. Again, restoredministry.com/survey, or just click on the link in the show notes. And if you do that by November 15th, you'll be entered to win a $100 Amazon gift card. That wraps up this episode. If you know someone who's struggling from their parents' divorce or broken marriage, share this podcast with them. Honestly, once it's over, just take 30 seconds to share this episode with them. And in closing, always remember, you are not alone. We're here to help you feel whole again and break the cycle of dysfunction and divorce in your own life. And keep in mind the words of C.S. Lewis, who said, "You can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending."